Back together again, you and I chatting it up, discussing things. Final show of the month of May, Friday, May the 30th, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. I opened the show wondering on a Friday when exactly the state of Connecticut took a lurch to the far left and how it operates and governs itself. Family Institute of Connecticut Director of Public Policy Leslie Wolfgang updated us regarding a controversial library bill being debated at the state capitol. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso, in his weekly slot, broke down the biggest local stories, including how a contentious housing bill in Hartford could affect Bridgeport and the local Fairfield County area. And we were joined by Yankee Institute blogger Andrew Fowler. He dropped by to chat about the state's continued difficulties in reducing electric bills.
So as much as we talk about it here on the program, I feel the need to keep reminding you folks, because you know, a lot of you call me and say, well, why do they think this way or that way in Hartford? And a lot of times, I don't know, but I need to remind you of the lunacy. Now, they're not all lunatics in Hartford. Not all of them. A good number of them are. But let me give you an example of how some people that make and craft the laws that you and I have to abide by willingly, and if we don't, we go to jail or prison or whatever. But let me give you an example of how out of touch some people are. And let me use this example. Now, you know, to his credit, and I have said this and I will continue to say it, I approve of Governor Lamont on this. He has said again he's going to veto that bill that would give unemployment benefits to striking workers. So some of the lunatics on the left in Hartford want striking workers who go on strike of their own volition to get unemployment benefits. It's ludicrous. That's not what unemployment is for. So you and I know that. We understand that. I've even have some Democrats calling this show and some people who are in unions, right, over the past few days, calling and saying, what is this? I had a couple of guys and gals call in and said, hey, I'm a union person or I'm a Democrat, but this is nuts. Huh? You know it's nuts. I know it's nuts. But the people that govern us in the majority in Hartford, they don't think it's nuts. And I was talking to somebody earlier today about why certain things happen in Hartford or why certain things don't happen. And I said, well, you know, XYZ legislator is a criminal defense attorney or a prosecutor or something. And this person said, well, no, they didn't know that. And I said, you know that the chairperson of this, that, or the other committee is a former union leader. Oh, I didn't know that. And this person said to me, well, isn't that a conflict of interest? I said, yeah, but that's why we're so screwed up. Let me give you this example here. This is from the Connecticut Examiner. Governor Lamont has been called stubborn and off-kilter for vowing to veto striker benefits. This is from the Connecticut Examiner. Now, most of us would sit here and think, hey, the governor is right on this one, to oppose that money from the unemployment benefit fund goes to people who willingly go on strike. But only in Hartford, with the leftists in Hartford, only in Hartford are they thinking they're correct and we're the crazy ones. State Senator Julie Kushner, Democrat Danbury, said, quote, the governor's wrong on this one, because he said he plans to once again veto a bill that would give unemployment benefits to striking workers after 14 days on strike. The Labor and Public Employees Committee chair telling the Connecticut Examiner on Thursday the bill had support from Democrats in both chambers and unions across the state, and she called Lamont stubborn. Seriously. And she does this with a straight face. So wait a minute, Senator, with all due respect, because the people in your party, because the Democrats in the House and the Democrats in the Senate, oh, and the unions, they want, so it should become law. So the rest of Connecticut doesn't count? A governor who was a business owner doesn't count? What kind of progressive leftist lunacy is going on in Hartford right now? It is mind-boggling. The disconnect, that's what it is, folks. The disconnect is mind-boggling. That you have an influential legislator saying, well, all the Democrats like this, and the unions like this, and the governor is stubborn. Seriously, how did we get here? Explain this to me. This is what I want to start with today. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Serious question. You know, I'm in my mid-60s now. Feel good. Knock on wood. God, you know, God bless me for as long as that lasts. But you and I grew up when Connecticut was a pretty balanced state, right? We had three House Republicans. We had three House Democrats. We had one Republican Senate member. We had one Democratic U.S. Senate member. The General Assembly always leaned Democrat, but it leaned Democrat, not lunatic. What happened to Connecticut? Can somebody help me out here? I'm dead serious. What happened to this when we used to be a well-balanced state that was considered a tax haven? Some of our cities had worldwide impact with the insurance industry in Hartford, with the healthcare industry in New Haven, with the manufacturing industry in Bridgeport. Connecticut was this amazing indicator of how great America was. Now, we're governed by lunatics who want to sue gun companies instead of really attacking the problems that cause violence and breakups of societal family units here. We have a committee chairwoman in Hartford with a union background saying, well, hey, the unions like this, all the Democrats like this. And she's publicly chastising her boss, calling the governor stubborn and off-kilter. When did the leftists take over in this state? I'm dead serious about this. What happened? Julie Kushner said, quote, if he really wants to support middle-class working families in the state of Connecticut, then he has to stand with the workers. Really? Boy, where does that come from? So I guess standing with businesses who employ those workers, Senator, doesn't count? Are you kidding me? Do you actually believe the stuff you're saying? She said, quote, I know he's stubborn, and when he takes a position, he likes to stick with it. But this is one he really needs to rethink. He's thinking off kilter, no question about it. I hope he comes to his senses. Folks, when did this happen? Well, is there a date on the calendar when Connecticut officially lapsed from being a clear-thinking, balanced, tax haven, well-run state to this lunacy we have now in Hartford, where a member of the party is openly and publicly chastising her boss because of her union background? Are you kidding me? Who the hell keeps electing these people? But then again, maybe that's the problem. Help me out here. Seriously. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. When did Connecticut become a haven for nuts? Now, I hope you folks are watching this. Not watching me, per se, although you can click on our video links and watch that, but on Twitch or on YouTube. But some of this vitriol being thrown at the governor by his own party makes me ask a question. When did Connecticut become such a haven for leftists? No, seriously, and I don't use that word lightly. These are not clear-thinking Democrats. These are leftists screaming at the head of their own party, the titular head of their party, the governor of Connecticut, who's been elected twice because he thinks signing a bill to give striking workers unemployment compensation is wrong. He's made the decision. Now, he says he's going to veto it. This time, I trust him at his word, but we'll see. And yet, have you seen what his own party is saying about him? You have Julie Kushner, the chair of the Labor Committee. This is nuts. quote, will be here next year and year after that. I'm confident the next governor will see things differently. This is exactly what I'm saying, folks. I'm telling you that a good amount of the legislators in Hartford despise Ned Lamont because he's not a leftist nut. Quote from Julie Kushner, I'm confident the next governor will see things differently. Folks, trust me on this. I'm telling you, if Susan Bicewicz is elected, if William Tong is elected, if Sean Scanlon is elected, if Luke Bronin is elected governor, they will make Ned Lamont look like Ronald Reagan. Trust me. You better think long and hard about how you vote next year if, in fact, Governor Lamont doesn't decide to run again. Julie Kushner's retort followed comments Lamont made at a Wednesday news conference. He called the bill a, quote, terrible signal to business. I don't think it's the right move for the state. I support the right to organize. I don't think a striking workers' bill is the way to go. Perfect clarity there from the governor. Whether you like him or not, that's perfect clarity from the governor. And the middle phrase he said in there, the quote, I don't think it's the right move for the state. See, that's the difference. I take Ned Lamont at his word that he's looking out for the state of Connecticut because he hangs out with guys and women and has contact with men and women who have a lot of money who probably tell him, Ned, there's no way I'm moving my business or any of my friends are because you're governed by a bunch of leftists. But the Democratic Party in Hartford, the majority, they're beholden to the unions and nobody else. Don't ever think that there's any more important constituency in Hartford than the unions, both the Connecticut State unions and the other municipal unions. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Inherently, every party, every faction of lawmaker has their constituency. But my God, the tantrum. I mean, they're acting like kids. You know, when you tell a kid, hey, honey, it's time. You got to put the toy away now. It's time to go to bed. You have to get up for school tomorrow. I don't want to. Ah, Bob Duff, our own Bob Duff in Fairfield County, Norwalk. Listen to what Bob Duff said. Listen to the tantrum he said the other day. Who are you standing up for? You would think he's criticizing a Republican. He's criticizing his boss, the governor. And when I ask, how did we get here? Do you think anybody would have said that to Bill O'Neill? Do you think anybody in an open debate would have said that to Ella Grasso? Even as recently as Dan Malloy, did you ever hear about a Democrat taking Dan Malloy publicly to the woodshed? So what has happened here? When did the Democratic majority segue from being clear-thinking moderates to leftists now? Because that's, well, they're not leftist, Paul. Well, it sure sounds that way. Here, listen to what Bob Duff said, openly chastising the governor. Quote, who are you standing up for? Are you standing up for the workers of the state? That's really what this bill is about. Those of us who've been on strike lines with workers understand how stressful and difficult it is. And really, the stress that comes from standing on a picket line and not knowing whether or not you're going to be able to pay your bills, put food on the table, and take care of your kids, especially if the strike lasts a long time. Well, but again, Senator, with all due respect, the workers decided to go on strike. Listen, it's good Pratt and Whitney settled the strike because that's what happens. Both sides come together and they say, hey, we're getting killed on this side. You're getting killed on that side. Let's take the best deal we can. But this is mind-numbing. But again, my question is a sincere one. Seriously, when did this happen? When did Connecticut, shall we say, segue? It's a big phrase we have here in the radio business, segueing records. When did Connecticut segue from being a balanced, albeit slightly progressive-leaning state, with a good tax structure, with relatively low crime, with good manufacturing, with legislators who didn't scream and yell at the governor and try to embarrass him? When did we go from that to the lunatics we have now in Hartford, who sound like, when the leader of their party says, no, this is a bad idea, come up with something else, they sound like a kindergarten class. They sound like nursery school. They sound like romper room. They sound like they're looking for Captain Kangaroo. Tell me, please, help me out here on a Friday at 333-9422. When exactly did this happen?
You may remember a couple of months ago, we told you about a bill that was introduced by Norwalk Democratic State Senator Bob Duff under the guise of libraries and librarians being under siege by these crazy parents who actually want some control over what their kids are able to access and not access. And our guest returns here now. She warned us about it a few weeks ago, and I guess maybe this is not going to happen. Now, Leslie Wolfgang joins us. She's the Director of Public Policy at the Family Institute of Connecticut. She's been up at the state capitol, I guess, all day today. Hey, Leslie, it's Paul again. Sure. How are you?
Hey, very good. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Did I read correctly or hear from some tweets and some text messages that the bill has been yanked? What's the deal here?
So this bill is very much on topic, and we're afraid that it's still going to pass.
Oh.
They tried to stuff it into a bill today, the education bill,
yeah,
an omnibus bill. They haven't voted on that bill yet, and there's an indication that they won't include the library bill in that omnibus bill. However, we know that they're still working very hard to pass that bill, the library bill, which takes rights away from parents to challenge sexually explicit books in the library, and Paul, even prevents parents from challenging drag queen story hour in their local schools. So very much alive. The Democrats are very much, Bob Duff is very much looking for a vehicle for this to pass. And we are working very hard and just contacting our legislators and telling them not to shut out the parents. Parents contribute to the process. They know kids best. Right?
Yeah.
And most librarians, I think, want to work with parents.
Mm-hmm.
And we shouldn't be shut out of the process.
And Leslie, from what I understand, from what you told me the first time, what I've been reading here, this is being couched as a bill by Mr. Duff and his cohorts here, is being couched as a bill to prevent book banning. Now, number one, we don't ban books in the United States. This is not, you cannot legally ban a book. So I guess they're trying to hide this as behind this, right, saying, well, this will prevent books from being banned. And that doesn't happen here. This is a question of how much say, correct me if I'm wrong, Leslie, that parents should have as to what is age appropriate for their child, correct?
Correct. And look, if just removing a porny book from the library is book banning, then librarians are the biggest book banners out there, right? Because they have to make decisions all the time on what books are on the shelves and what aren't. This is just about including the input of parents and members of the community and helping to discern what is appropriate and on the shelves in your local school library and your local public library. And this is absolutely shutting parents out of the process. And librarians, I get it. You don't want to be challenged.
Sure.
They don't, you know, nobody likes to be challenged. But I get challenged. You get challenged. Legislators get challenged. Some books totally deserve to be challenged.
Mm-hmm.
Some programs like Drag Queen Story Hour deserve to be challenged. And parents are the ones being banned from the library with this bill.
And you told me last time, and I know you emailed me the particulars on this last time, Leslie, that I guess they're trying to hide behind, well, you can have a challenge, but then I remember this being, you have to wait a certain amount of time. In other words, there were, under the guise of challenges, a lot of restrictive things in there, correct?
So, yes. And one of the prohibitions on things you can't make a challenge to is based on whether or not the book or the program has a viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, so I'm sorry, but everything has a viewpoint.
Sure.
So if that's the standard, if you can't, if a book cannot be removed from the shelves or if a program cannot be canceled based on its viewpoint, then what can it be canceled for? This prohibits any program from being canceled because of its viewpoint. So you have the viewpoint of a character, or if the book has a viewpoint about pornography or a viewpoint about sexually explicit material,
mm-hmm.
that this bill prevents it from being removed because of that viewpoint. And if it can't be removed, that means no parent can challenge it. Now, we're not even talking about the 3-year restriction or whether or not a parent's child is currently enrolled, which is another layer of excluding parents. But no, even the Board of Education, our elected officials, will not be able to stop a drag queen story hour if a librarian determines that that is a protected viewpoint or material that should be presented to the children. And that's outrageous.
Mm.
Okay. We don't have a banning problem in Connecticut.
No, we don't.
In all of 2024, do you know how many books were challenged in Connecticut? This
Challenged in a full year. Give
17.
Me
17.
I was going to say 10. Challenged. Yeah. 17.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we don't have, you know how many libraries are? There are over 1,000 libraries in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So this is not a problem. This is a scare tactic. This is Senator Duff seeing what's happening in other states and ginning up opposition and support for opposition to parents participating in schools. Okay? We have a strong foundation in this state of parents being involved, of local communities controlling their libraries. This usurps that. This is the state telling boards of education and library boards that they have to have a program, and this is what the program's going to be. This is how you're going to review books. And it excludes parents for challenging these books, and it prevents us from removing any book because it has a viewpoint expressed. It's just so broad and outlandish to me.
Yeah, in a state where people can't pay their electric bills, they're worried about this. Leslie, keep me up to date on this. You know how to text me on this. Leslie Wolfgang, the Director of Public Policy at the Family Institute of Connecticut.
Thank you so much. Let me just give our website,
ctfamily.org.
Yeah. ctfamily.org. We have the latest information and news for people to contact their legislators.
All right. Thanks, Leslie. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care. Be safe.
Yep. Thank you.
CTFamily.org. Every 5:15 or so, every Friday afternoon, Chris Caruso joins us. We sit there and chat, if you will, about what's going on locally and statewide. Mr. Caruso, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Happy Friday, Paul.
Chris, do you miss the end of session demolition derby that's going on right now at the state capitol?
No, I loved working with my colleagues. I loved the process. We'll do it all over again, Paula. The experience was great to represent Bridgeport. I felt I did a lot of things to make a difference, but these last days of session are always put a lot of pressure and stress on people. And no, I don't miss that portion of it, especially the late nights when I was up there. We go to 2-3 in the morning sometime. When the income tax first began, we would do around the clock. We'd go in at 10 in the morning. The next day we had to be at 10 in, and we didn't leave till 6 in the morning that day. So 4 hours later, we had to be back in again. So it's a little different now. They usually end the session about 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
The speaker is good about that. I don't know about tonight. Years ago, we had to go in on that Saturday. So tomorrow we would go in and do a whole day. I don't know if that will be the case tomorrow. But again, what we've talked about, that funnel, all the legislation's going through the funnel. You have really less than about 5 days left.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything has to go through. Some will, some won't. That's why you're seeing what's referred to as aircraft carriers. That's where the bill they're debating now has 63 sections to it. So that's the word aircraft carriers.
Before we get to the individual bills, I said this. I've been saying this over the last couple of years, because every time this happens, I don't think it's good for the legislative process. Do you ever think down the road, Chris, having experienced this and watching this as you do, that Connecticut may want to consider what other states do and have a full-time legislature with no time limits, no boundaries? Would that make for better lawmaking or not?
No, I don't think so, Paul. But I think legislators should be compensated for the extra time they're putting in. You know, it's always started out as a part-time position.
Yeah.
And years ago, the legislature was created because of the farms in the state.
Yeah.
You know, you had to plant the seeds and then, you know, reap the harvest. And so that's how we got into these sessions that mm-hmm. begin 3 months and some are 5 months and so forth.
Yeah.
But what's happened over the years, the part-time position has kind of morphed into a full-time position in many ways. So I think you have to compensate people for that, but not necessarily create a full-time legislator. Nor do I think, frankly, that there's a will in the legislature to do it. You have a lot of professionals
yeah.
that have law practices, accounting firms, mm-hmm. and so forth, and I don't think they would want to give that up for a full-time legislature. And I think you'd also have conflicts of interest that you'd have to address and so forth. I think the legislative process works and works well. I know people get upset when they don't get a bill passed they want, and when some bills pass, they get angry about it too. But I think it works, you know, very well for based on the number of people you're dealing with. What's 187 people
yep.
trying to get legislation through. And overall, I think it works and it's worked well. But I've always felt that you have to compensate people because they're putting extra time.
Sure.
When I was there, we would do summer meetings,
yeah.
Summer events. You know, you're out in your district all the time to stay in connection with people. So I think you've got to compensate for that,
yeah.
but not necessarily, you know, make it a full-time legislature, no.
Okay, a couple of bills. Let's talk about that housing bill, Chris. Were you not happy at PAD? There were some Democratic defections here. You in particular, yeah. Chris, told me that you were concerned about eliminating the ability of cities and towns to bring parking into the question here. What are your thoughts on what happened?
Well, I think bill number 5002, which you did a nice job on, Paul, I think last week.
Thank you.
You had a discussion on it. That bill passed by only 8 votes, believe it or not, 8 votes.
Yeah.
And there were city legislators that opposed it. And the bill hasn't changed drastically. There were 2 amendments put in, but the minimum parking is not something that is important in the bill, frankly.
Mm.
You know, now they're saying if you have 24 units of apartment dwelling, anything above that, then you have to have mandatory parking. So under 24, you can build something with no parking. The bill seems very top-heavy toward developers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're seeing that in Bridgeport. A lot of New York developers are coming in, building this
sure.
type of housing. And without parking, their profits go up. And the only ones who are experiencing the hardship are the people who live in the area, not only the ones who just rent an apartment, but those who are living in the community or neighborhood for quite some time. The other thing in the bill, which I think is detriment, especially to cities, it takes commercial properties and you could develop housing in them.
Yeah.
and in Bridgeport, our grand list, our commercial development, has been dropping. Now, how are you going to support the city without a strong commercial base?
Mm.
But yet it seems this mad rush to affordable housing. And the question is, what affordable housing?
Sure, yep.
And then there's also in the bill, luxury apartments could be built too. So the luxury apartments are only going to benefit the developers. And so there's enough in that bill that it should have been opposed. I always felt that if a town has reached or is working toward reaching their goal of affordable housing,
mm-hmm.
they should be given an exception. Same thing with cities that have already reached and exceeded their goal of affordable housing. But that bill didn't address those issues. So now the bill moves over to the Senate. I've been talking to a few of the senators there who are opposing the bill.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's enough support to
wow.
stop it.
Wow, interesting.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, we will see.
We'll see.
You know, there's parts of the bill next year, if there's a concerted effort, where changes could be made. You know, this was the first bill out of the gate. If it passes, it passes. But next year, there'll be an attempt to come back and make changes.
Yeah. Two more things, Chris, quickly. Governor Lamont, boy, I tell you, I don't envy the guy. On the budget issue, Chris, on the extra spending here and there, nursing homes and Medicaid, he's juggling here like crazy. He's trying to keep everybody happy. I mean, this is like herding cats on this thing.
Yeah, it really is. And he's up against it in many ways because he's got pressure from, you know, both aisles of the legislature, you know, Republicans, Democrats. And he's trying to walk that line. You just heard St. Joseph's Manor in Trumbull is closing.
Yeah,
they announced that they're moving to closing, partly because of the Medicaid reimbursement.
Mm.
It's not enough to operate these nursing facilities. Now, that's a facility over 100 beds in it.
Yeah.
You know, what's going to happen to that property, you know?
Mm.
So there's a lot of those issues coming along. I don't envy his position. I think what he has to do is follow his heart and his mind and his soul and do what's in the best interest of the people of the state. I think that's, in the end, as long as he can explain his actions,
yeah.
I think that's all that matters, you know?
Yeah. Finally, Chris, you've probably seen this, and I did an early segment or two on this. I am shocked. Now, listen, you can disagree with a governor of your own party on legislation. It happens all the time, all over the country.
Sure.
I am shocked at the verbal vitriol from a lot of people that's being tossed at Governor Lamont, who was still the titular head of his party, regarding him saying, hey, I don't think this bill to pay strikers is a good idea. And he says, listen, we've done this for working people, but he just doesn't done that. He just doesn't like it. You know, I favor him on that. But boy, the stuff that Bob Duff and Julie Kushner and the unions are saying, I'm like, wow, where did we descend to this level of vitriol, Chris?
That's what's happened in politics across the board, Paul. And I think a lot of it comes from the national politics.
Yeah.
And it's creeped its way into the states and the local municipalities. And there isn't this healthy debate, disagreement between political people any longer. It's these personal attacks or, you know, demonizing people, which is never good. I don't think you're going to get to where you want to be by that.
Yeah.
And I've always found Lamont to be one to sit down and try to work
with
people.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't close the door. He's very open to Republican views, Democratic views, and he tries to work on it. And I think with a lot of legislation, that should be the approach. Sit down with them, try to work something out. But, you know, when you start throwing rocks, it's going to come back.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it doesn't always work the right way. So I think there's that pressure, too, probably from some legislators, because if he vetoes the bill, which he's talked about it, they won't have enough votes to override it.
Yeah.
You know, just right now in the House, that bill for striking workers passed in concurrence with the Senate. But the vote in the House was 89-59.
Yep.
So in order to override the veto, you need 101 votes.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think in the long term, it would have been better for the legislators, the unions to sit down, business to sit down with the governor and get somewhere in the middle that everyone could agree on.
Yeah.
Now the bill will go down if there's not enough votes to override the veto.
Yeah. Chris, have a good weekend. Don't watch too much CTN, okay? Remember, you're not up there anymore, Chris. You don't.
I'm addicted.
Chris, if you ask for a point of order, nobody's going to answer it, okay?
No, that's exactly right, Paul.
All right, Chris, be good. We'll talk next week. All right, there you go. Former Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso. Andy Fowler joins us, an author and staffer at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Check him out, yankeeinstitute.org. And Andy has authored a great essay. And Andy, how are you, man? Good to have you back on. How you been?
I've been very well, thank you. How about you?
Good, Andy. Listen, I read your stuff and I started to laugh. Not at your stuff. I laughed because you point out very salient points here about our energy needs in Connecticut, because I'm laughing here knowing that, Andy, I'm sorry I have to say this, but you may concur with me, nothing's going to change. There is nothing that's going to happen to address any of the salient points you bring out here. And, Andy, I don't know if you know this. We're, what, number two in the country average electric bill? I think we trail Hawaii by $10 a month. Hey, what the heck, Andy? Let's become number one. We could be number one in something, right? But
there's the Talladega Nights line of if you ain't first, you're last, right?
So, But, Andy, this piece is great. Why Connecticut has one of the highest electric rates in the U.S. And you very nicely, Andy, and talk about this to my listeners, you spell out the four or five major issues that we never seem to address here.
Yeah. So several of the major issues, maybe all of them, can be laid at the Capitol's doorstep. So it's, you know, mostly regulations, environmental regulations, having no not constructing more natural gas pipelines, or even, you know, New York blocking the Constitution pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And you would say those are probably the major players, but, you know, major causes. But, you know, with going for these, you know, net zero or decarbonization goals, you know, if we try to switch from wind and solar for renewable energy sources only, it could cost New England over $815 billion through 2050. And that's just unfeasible at this rate. And, you know, you have people struggling. This is a really big affordability issue. You know, we're almost coming up to a year when people found out that these electric bills about the public benefits charge, mm-hmm. you know, shot up the wazoo. And yet the best solution that our lawmakers are coming up with is borrowing $260 million a year,
yeah.
which the taxpayers will have to pay in the long run. It,
mm-hmm.
As I make a point, it reeks kind of like Popeye's Wimpy. I'd gladly pay you Tuesday for a burger today. You know, so it's like this, that's not real relief. We need a clear and honest strategy for both short and long-term solutions.
Our friend Mark Fitch, and you cite this in a link, Andy Fowler, on your blog here, has pointed out, and I didn't realize this, we actually use, Connecticut does, nearly 20% less energy than everybody else does in the U.S., which is startling because, A, it shows again how we're getting screwed, but, B, if people will just naturally, if you give them choices, they will gravitate toward what they know is right. So the conservation part of this, Andy, certainly sounds like it's happening here.
Yeah, no, when I saw that Connecticut uses nearly 20% less electricity than the national average, it did add insult to injury a little bit. People really are starving for, real relief. You know, you had last year this guy, Scott Pearson from Monroe.
Sure, I've had him on.
Launched
yep.
that online
yep.
petition that had mm-hmm. 75,000 signatures to talk about address the public benefits charge. It's there is a great concern out there for energy relief, and we can't keep kicking the can down the road. But again, most of this lies with government mandates. Like, you have these the rules that were passed in the late 90s called the Renewable Portfolio Standard.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these other, executive orders to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Now, you know, our main point, though, is not, clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment, those are good goals. But, you know, people, what happens when you sustain an 18-hour-plus blackout? You know, there are lives at stake, people who need that power and need that energy, not just for, you know, everyday things like charging a phone, but, for medical devices and whatnot. So it's like, this is a really serious issue. So it's like, how do we balance both being environmentally friendly as possibly can, but also, boost our economic prosperity and growth, and also make energy affordable, because we want people to stay, grow, and thrive here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Andy, and finally, in about the minute we have left, I had to laugh, and you probably saw this too. A couple of months ago, or maybe a month ago, Governor Lamont was at some sort of forum where he said, we have energy problems. One thing I want to do, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, was we need to bring in and use more natural gas. And he got booed. He got booed.
Yeah.
Like the poor guy must sit up there and say, what am I going to do? I always ask on this show, Andy, what is anybody for that actually works? And everybody says,
right.
More natural gas. That's what you got to do. Does it ever happen? No.
Right. And, Governor Lamont, to his credit, rightly said of that, we do need more natural gas because, you know, if we try to build nuclear power, which could meet those clean energy and affordable energy needs, you know, if the infrastructure for that is probably, you know, a decade or decade away. So what do we have in the meantime is, you know, natural gas. And also he came out in support of reforming or rethinking the Jones Act as well, which is a federal law, which actually it makes it harder to import goods between U.S. ports and also drives up energy costs as well. So, you know, he's talked about some pretty good policy initiatives in on that regard. But it's a shame that, you know, natural gas, it's cheap, but it's there. We could save if this Constitution pipeline were built. If New York didn't block it, we could save New Englanders about $1 billion in energy costs.
Can't do that.
Seems like a no-brainer.
Can't do that. Why would we want to save people money? No, we can't. We don't do that here in Connecticut. Hey, the name of the piece is Why Connecticut Has One of the Highest Electric Rates in the U.S. Andy Fowler, the author at the Yankee Institute. Read it, folks. It outlines in easy, digestible fashion what the problem is. YankeeInstitute.org. Andrew, thank you. We appreciate it. We'll be in touch, man. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.